wait years. Just, you know, he'll say, I remember one time particularly with this one man who was so difficult. Everybody just had so much trouble with him. Swami said, you know, it's just been too much. I'm going to speak to him. And he did speak to him 4.5 years later. But it was a straight line from the decision to speak to him to 4.5 years later, but there was never a good moment in between. And finally, there was the moment, and in that moment, he accomplished his goal, because his goal wasn't to have the wonderful moment of telling him what he did wrong. The goal was to help him to be better. And there was no compulsion inside of Swami to have to say it, because his happiness didn't depend on making this man different. His happiness came from really being a friend to him. Now, wouldn't we rather really be a friend to our spouse instead of having all the satisfaction of being right? You know, we can be right all by ourselves in our apartments later on, after we've driven everyone out of our life. You know? Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Joe.
Can you just elaborate a little on the making a project out of helping people? It seems to me like that's more of a natural thing for women than it is for men or me. You know, it doesn't seem as kind of a natural compulsion if you want to change or make a project out of changing the other person. And, I mean, I can sort of see it in my own head as a divine role that we play to help each other grow. But also it seems like more of a...
Well, don't think of it like that, because, Joe, if I said to you, don't you enjoy being friends with people?
Right.
I mean, that's all I'm saying. All I'm talking about is friendship.
Well, I guess the idea of just talking about making a project about changing people just pushes buttons, and I just wonder, what is that?
Well, I hope I didn't actually say that. Because what I really mean is, if you love someone and you notice that they have habits that are making them miserable, you know, they tend to fall into pits of despair, or they have a tendency to give in to anger, or they tend to see other people's doing things to them that make them all feel resentful, or they feel unloved by God, or inadequate as devotees. You know, make a list. Everybody has, you live with someone and you see that they constantly fall into delusions that you know are false delusions, and you don't want them to suffer. So you think to yourself, how can I help you?
The difference is their soul need versus your need.
Yes, exactly.
Correct.
Exactly. And if you see, and maybe you don't really make any project out of it because that's not your nature, but what you just are is kind and supportive. And you just don't add fuel to the fire.
How does that tie in with the not giving advice? Advice.
That's kind of what I was asking.
Well, you just kind of play it by ear, Joe. I mean, to not give advice doesn't mean someone says, well, you know, what do you think about it? I never give advice. It means don't have the thought in your mind that it's my job to advise. You can give your opinion, you can share thoughts, but it's the thought of I'm advising you. That's what he's really talking about. He's talking about the consciousness behind it. Oh, well, now that you've asked me, I'm so glad because for the last 6 years I've been thinking about what you need to do. You know, or just, you know, you see someone and you just have a tendency to say, well, you know, actually you have this delusion because this is how you feel. And of course, you know, I used to have that problem, but I don't have that problem anymore because of this. That's what he means. Okay. Not magnetic. But sitting together and talking and someone saying, you know, they made me so mad when they did this and I just got so mad I wanted to hit them. And you can say, well, gosh, did that work? You know, and then you just start a conversation. You just share what your point of view is, but it's not the point of view of I'm instructing you because I know. That's really what we're talking about. Okay? So any other thoughts or questions? But, you know, Joe's question is valid. You don't want to become like a scientific, like you're conducting a science experiment. And that's why you say motherliness. You know, a mother, it's not her project to raise the child. You know, if you're doing that, it's so inhuman, it's not right. It's friendship. It's you're there for each other. You just do what is needful in order to make it a happy time. If couples related as mother and child and friend to friend all the time, you know, then there would be no problems. Because we just don't do really awful things in those contexts. I mean, in those ideal contexts. If you have a friend, you don't have that sense that my happiness depends on what you do and therefore you have to change. You know, it's just your friend, and sometimes they're kind of clunky and you wish they weren't so clunky, but, you know, they're clunky. It's not a problem. Let's just go to the movies. But when it's your spouse that's clunky, you get hysterical about it, right? Because there's all this whatever delusion. Friend to friend. And then when in doubt, think like a mother.
What if your father?
Pardon me?
What if your father?
Think like a mother.
You don't
think
like a mother.
No, they can. Motherly love. No, you have to understand. I'm not talking feminine. I'm talking about unselfish, appropriate, concerned with other people's reality, giving. And that can come through a man or a woman. And if you're male, it'll come through you conceivably in a male fashion. But it can still be unselfish, concerned with the other's reality. But you'll give to that person what you have to give. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't mean that every man has to be a female or every female has to be female. But the concept of it, because Divine Mother can be quite male in the sense of just this is what you need and this is what you're going to get. You know, and a good mother has male and female qualities in them, and a good father has all qualities. Do you understand the difference? It's being able to, it's just the knowledge that I have to discipline myself because that's my responsibility. And see, a mother knows she has to discipline herself. A parent knows they have to discipline themselves because it's my responsibility to be mature. But in a relationship with spouse, we think I don't have any responsibility to be mature. And that's like, sure, you don't, but you won't have anything at the end of it either. You won't grow together. You may stay together, but you won't grow together. Does that make sense? All right, I think that's enough bad news for one night. Oh, but let me say one more thing. You know, it seems difficult, but I'll tell you, hurting each other and losing your relationships is hell, right? And disciplining yourself appears to be difficult, but it isn't, because you get what you want from it. Do you understand what I mean? What is really hell is not doing it. And we're very confused. We don't realize this. But the opposite is what brings us to hell. And just a little bit of maturity, a little bit of self-control brings you everything that you want. Even a little bit goes a long way. Okay, that's enough. All right. Do we have any questions or comments or thoughts from previous classes before we get started on this one? Yes, Sarah?
What about boundaries?
Well, it's the same question that Patricia asked last time. You know, people, it's that whole discussion. The question is, if people have a lot of negative things, how do you deal with it? First, you have to decide how much you have to relate to people whose energy is incompatible with yours. You can write letters and just not see them as much. And that was that whole discussion. If you can't handle it, don't expose yourself to it. And the other thing is, you don't have to interact nearly as much as you think you do. People can be quiet. I think those are really the two best answers. You should just avoid company that really pulls you down as much as you can without being cruel. And then don't interact. Or don't set yourself up in situations. You know, go to movies, watch videos, play cards. You know, just don't set yourself up in situations and try to have a lighthearted attitude. I know some of you have heard the story that I tell you about my friend Paula, who was just a master at disarming people with sweetness. And so she just wouldn't fight. She would just refuse to engage. The story that I often tell is when a mutual friend of ours was dying of cancer in her early 30s. Paula herself has since died of cancer. But this woman, Shraddha, her father, Jake, had come. Shraddha was married and her husband was taking care of her, but Jake was very attached to her, and Shraddha and Jake had a very close but problematic relationship. And so Jake had come because his daughter was dying and his wife had died of cancer. I mean, it was a very painful and awful situation. And Jake was sort of like taking over the house. And we called, Paula and myself and another friend, to see if we could come visit Shraddha. And Jake said, no, 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 you can't come. So we sort of hung up the phone and discussed among ourselves whether or not we should be bound by Jake. And we all agreed that Sharada really wouldn't have wanted to, Jake to run her life if she was well enough to know, so she probably wouldn't want it now. So we went and just knocked on the door, and we showed up. And Paula knew Jake a little bit. We all knew him a little. And Jake, when he saw us, he became very uptight and said, I thought I told you not to come. And I would have responded very differently. Fortunately, I had the sense to stand back. Paula said, she just looked right in his eyes, she said, Jake, we just had to come. Just like that. And Jake said again, I told you not to come, she's too tired. Jake, she said, we just had to come. And by the time she said it the third time, he said, all right, but don't stay long. But it was, she just disarmed him because she refused to get on that wavelength. And so sometimes if people are being really negative, just don't get on the wavelength. Just say, I know how you feel. I'm not gonna argue with you about it. I know that we disagree, but let's just not go there. You know? And you have to do it really. You have to really do it like Paula did it, like Jake, I'm not gonna go there. I'm just here being myself, and I'm just not gonna go where you are. I know you want to fight with someone because your daughter's dying. I understand that. But it's not gonna be me. And she just sort of just got under it. Just got right under it, and he just didn't know what to do. We just sailed right in. You know? So it's just the thought that you have to engage is a complete delusion. If you don't want to, don't. And if you refuse to, nothing will happen. You know, that there may be a lot of silence, but that's better. All right. Any other questions or thoughts? It works with spouses too, yes. I said it works with spouses too, yes.
Mm-hmm. We discussed this quite a bit last time, but just to recapitulate, when you have a piece of advice for your spouse and you know it's something that
they don't
make them better, and the issue of whether to try to have it as to have subtle hints or not, there's a difference between trying and not trying, whether you're emotionally attached. If I'm emotionally attached to something, I probably shouldn't try to do.
If you really want to say it, that's a clue that you shouldn't say it. I mean, one of the ways to tell whether you really should say it or not is how much you want to. If you really, really want to, you probably shouldn't, because you're coming from your own need to say it, not from the other person's, not from intuition and not from the other person's receptivity to it. They may coincide, but not always. They often won't. And if you feel anxious and really eager, the wrong kind of eagerness. You know, you can be eager in a very joyful sort of way, like I finally have the last piece of the puzzle and we can drop it in. But there's a kind of ego involvement. Almost everything can be left unsaid. It's quite surprising. Especially if you, I don't mean suppressed, I just mean things will come out if they're meant to. But one doesn't have to really push with one's ego nearly as much as we think we do. I mean, you know, 1/8 of 1% or 1/10 of 1% is about how much you actually have to push compared to how much we do. Just things will happen if you're there to be an instrument much more readily than if you're pushing it. And so you just experiment with it. And pray, as I said last week, to the soul of the person you love and you want to help, and ask them to help you find the right time to say it. Because, you see, the trick is, and it's a trick of the mind and a trick of vocabulary you have to work with. They would be better for knowing this. They might be better for knowing this, but they won't be better for your telling them this. And so we get like a unity in our minds between them knowing it and our telling them. And so they would be better for knowing it, but the question is, will my telling them actually result in their knowing it? And that's where the intuition has to come in, and that's where the detachment has to come in. We have a tremendous desire in our culture to just tell each other where it's at. And I always hate it when people just sort of lay it out in front of me. I mean, I can bite the bullet and be brave and very straightforward about it. We all learn to be. But it always hurts your feelings. I mean, sometimes it is okay, but so often feelings get hurt, and then it's a really hard thing to overcome. Sometimes feelings have to be hurt. You can't go through life being terrified of hurting people's feelings. But just be careful. That's all. You know, I'm very frank. People are very frank with me, and by and large, I appreciate it. But still, you know, you really should be conscious. Any other comments, questions? All right. The topic for this evening is sexuality in marriage, sexuality in general. It's a big topic. And I used to talk about this a lot more. I sort of lost interest in talking about it, so I'll do my best tonight. Swamiji once made the comment to me that one of the biggest difficulties in devotee marriages was sex, which seems like such a sort of unoriginal comment you would expect, because the biggest difficulty in so many relationships is sexuality. Why would he particularly mention it in the context of devotees? But there's a sort of unique capacity to become extraordinarily confused on the spiritual path, because there's a great many things that you read. Yogananda himself makes many very direct statements, and the scriptures just altogether, you know, are not really advocates of sensuality or sexuality. So when you start just reading the teachings just as it's written, you don't end up with a lot of endorsements for sex. And you end up, in fact, with some pretty scary sort of diatribes against what a snare and a delusion it is. And yet we all find ourselves, like right here in our little human bodies, and having these compelling feelings for one another that seem to go against the scripture, and there you are. It's one of those extremely important examples that I was talking about on Swami's birthday, in fact. Why I myself am always very careful not to just take even Yogananda's words just flat without sort of hearing Swamiji's interpretation of them. Because just because something is written as this is the way it is doesn't mean that this is the way I'm supposed to do it right today. And when Swamiji was talking about sexuality and marriages among devotees, he says, because people's spiritual aspiration can get so sort of mixed up with psychological and subconscious issues, and then one or the other, what happens too often is one or the other of the couple sort of gets the idea in their head that it would be more spiritual if we weren't so sexual, and then that becomes a sort of imposition upon the relationship, and before you know it, the guilt and the confusion and the sense of spiritual failure becomes so complicated that sometimes you can never take it apart again. And it's an extremely real thing. And so we're always caught between these two realities. On the one hand, there is simple truth in the fact that sexuality is vastly overemphasized in our culture. Just, I mean, you can't even begin to talk about how overemphasized it is. And much of all, in fact, of course, of what Yogananda writes, but the directional idea indicated by all uplifted treatises on marriage want to put sexuality back into balance. But I think Swamiji's analysis in here is so balanced, the way he talks about it, because he talks about there's a certain expenditure of energy, and we don't necessarily lose energy by expending energy, but it's not necessarily sexuality that actually gives us energy. It's the state of consciousness, of joy and of love and of sharing and of intimacy and of friendship that is life-giving. And that sex per se is more a means to the end, to that end, rather than such an end in itself. And he gives comment to, which all the scriptures talk about, which cannot be ignored, the difference between sex for men and sex for women in terms of what it takes out of the physical body. And nobody likes to talk about that at all, but Swami says it very directly and bluntly, that the creation of semen in the male body takes a great deal of energy from the male body. And he says it very simply. It doesn't show at first that individuals, especially men, who overindulge in sex, it taxes the body over time. And so energy that constantly has to go to replenish that the lost energy, or to just like... you know, when the woman is bearing a child, oftentimes women will lose their teeth or other things will happen to them because the physical body automatically prioritizes the perpetuation of the species. And if the mother has to be sacrificed, the baby will get what's needed. And so it is in the male, who doesn't carry the child, but protecting the semen and making sure that the semen is there and is strong. And if it's constantly spent, then the body has to manufacture more, and as a result, not enough energy is left to keep the rest of the systems running, which is why young men who overindulge in sexuality often end up looking like old men much sooner than individuals who are more moderate in their expression and also more integrated in their sexual expression. Okay, so we start out just with the sort of basic like reconciling of the yogic ideas. But the other side of this whole coin, which is perhaps needs to be talked about more, I don't know, is the simple fact that we can't get there from here without going through the middle.